Welcome to Opto Sessions, where we interview the brightest minds from the stock market, uncovering their secrets to success. If you're looking for ideas, tips, and techniques from the world's best, you're in the right place. Today, I have the delight of introducing the one and only Gregory Zuckerman. Greg is a special writer at the Wall Street Journal, where he talks about big financial trades, firms, and the titans of Wall Street. Gregory has released 5 books, which include The Greatest Trade Ever, which is how hedge fund manager John Paulson bet against the markets and made $20 billion, and also his latest popular release, The Man Who Solved the Markets, how Jim Simons launched the quant revolution. In our conversation, we dig into detail on how Rentec was able to make 66% a year over a 30-year period, making it the most successful hedge fund of all time. We also touch on what Greg believes to be the common traits that make the titans of Wall Street as successful as they are. Enjoy. Hi, Greg. It's an honor to have you on the show today. How's everything going in New York? I assume you're in New York.
I'm actually in New Jersey, so a suburb of New York, and we're holding our own. You know, it was a difficult time. We've gotten through it, and we're managing, I guess you could say, much like the rest of the world.
Sure. Now, you obviously interviewed a lot of people over your career, or written about a wide variety of people as well, exceptionally interesting people. I just wanted to start by asking you, who's the most interesting personality you've interviewed or written about over the years and why? And it could be from finance or outside of finance.
It would have to be Jim Simons. I wrote a book about him recently. He's a fascinating individual in a lot of regards. He's got this record-breaking track record when it comes to investing, but he's also a math prodigy and accomplished a lot in the world of mathematics. As an academic, he's accomplished a lot. As a philanthropist, trying to do things like come up with treatments for autism, discover how the universe began, the nature of life, first few minutes and moments. So he's had a broad impact. He subsidizes school teachers. He's a fascinating guy, and he's also interesting because he both does the investing and the math side, but he's also a really good manager. He understands people, and that's a rare quality to have sort of both sides of the brain. So, yeah, I find him fascinating.
And are you able to just give a quick background of like how you got to where you are today? A brief overview, nothing too in-depth. Obviously, you've achieved a lot over your career, so it'd be interesting for everyone to know a little bit more.
Sure. Grew up in Providence, Rhode Island, smallest state in the United States. Always wanted to get into finance and do finance. Studied political science in university. Could not get a job, let alone a job. I couldn't get an interview in finance. When I graduated, it was a tough time on Wall Street. I didn't know anyone. I didn't spend any time working internships and such. I was mostly enjoying myself summers. And stumbled into the world of journalism. It was sort of a way to get at finance. And I didn't realize I would enjoy it. Never thought about being a journalist, but it's been a blessing. So I get to write about the world of finance. It's even better than my world, in my view, than doing it. I get to talk to all kinds of fascinating individuals. I get to have something of an impact on the world. So I started at a little newsletter, worked my way up, went to the New York Post, a daily newspaper, and then I've been at the Wall Street Journal for 23 years, since 1996.
Amazing. And you're also a 3-time winner of the Jared Loeb Award, I believe that's right, is it?
Yeah, that's, people in the world of financial journalism know about it. No one else really does, and neither should they. But it's, sort of like the Academy Awards for our world of financial journalism. I've covered a bunch of different things. I've broken different stories. I've written about the London Whale, my baby. So I've done different big stories over the years. I've had my shares of stories that got away, the fish bit that got away as well. So I've had successes and failures like anybody else in a career. And I've written 5 books, 2 for children or young people, 8 to 14, called Rising Above. It's a series where my sons and I met with sports stars, athletes around the world who overcame challenges in their youth. And we try to inspire young people with stories and talking to them and lessons about how they overcame different challenges, be it racism or poverty or physical differences, abuse. And I've written 3 books for adults, financial books. One is called The Greatest Trade Ever. And that's about those who anticipated the financial meltdown, including John Paulson. The other is called The Frackers. And that's about this revolution in which people have embraced fracking and horizontal drilling to turn the United States into an energy power and affect everything, geopolitics, the environment, etc. And my most recent book is called The Man Who Solved the Market, about that individual I just mentioned, Jim Simons, and his colleagues who created the greatest trading firm in history.
Yep. It's a great book. And yeah, I'd like to dig into that in a bit more detail now. And it was, as far as I think I recall, you had over 400 interviews with various individuals that worked at the hedge fund Renaissance Technologies to construct the book. Are you able to give us sort of brief overview of what the book's about as well? And then we'll dig into some of the details that are quite interesting that have come up.
Sure. It's not a biography, but it's got a lot of biographical elements about this one individual, Jim Simons, who grew up outside the city of Boston in the United States, always loved math, was very good at math, did his university in 3 years, gave a PhD, started teaching. And then he left to break code for the government. He had a career where he was working for an organization that was assisting the United States government in combating the Russians, USSR at the time, and the Cold War. And it was a whole interesting period there where they're developing code and breaking code. And then he left to be an academic, started a university, run a university math department, and did his own mathematics. And it's stuff that's groundbreaking. It still has an impact on the world today. And then he gave it all up to try to master the world of trading. And this is 1978, and he spent years trying to get it right. Even as late as 1990, they were still trying to figure out the right approach. He went back and forth. There's a lot of trial and error and failure along with success. And they finally figured out some unique approaches that are groundbreaking and really today are pioneering. So today, a lot of the world of investing is quantitative, be it either determined by systems, as we call it, mathematical, inspired trading systems that are automated to a large extent. So a lot of the world has sort of embraced Jim Simons' approach, but he was the pioneer. So there are lessons there, but also, there are also some lessons in terms of management. So he recruited really well. He gave incentives to people. He was able to get people to work with each other, unlike anything I've ever seen before. These are sort of headstrong, stubborn, really smart, accomplished mathematicians, scientists from all over the world. So half the book is sort of how they made their money and half the book is what they did with their money. And a lot of ways it brought a lot of tension because Jim Simons is a left-leaning guy. And one of his key employees, a guy named Bob Mercer, is a right-leaning guy. He was behind the Trump election. He was behind Brexit. He was behind Breitbart, behind a lot of controversial phenomena over the last few years and movements. So that's sort of in a nutshell what the book is about and how they made the money, then what it did to them.
Yeah. And how in particular did you come across Jim Simons and what inspired you to create this book?
So I've been at the Wall Street Journal, as I said, 23 years, and I often write about investors, big investors, sometimes smaller investors. And if you write about investors on Wall Street, you keep hearing about this individual, Jim Simons, largely because his returns are just absurd. 66% a year on average since 1988, which is just incredible. No one comes close. So I'd always heard about him. I always wanted to write about him. We have written a story here or there, but they're the most secretive firm Wall Street's ever seen. So I was always told, don't write about him. He told me not to write about them. He said he wouldn't talk to me. But in some ways, that sort of presented a challenge that I sort of wanted to embrace. Maybe I shouldn't have. So I always kind of heard about their reputation. I wanted to figure out, everyone wanted to know how they did it. So I set out to try to explain how they did it.
And if we could distill it down, what do you think of the, you've mentioned management, what else do you think are the core reasons behind Jim's success in particular? Because he's been so much more successful than majority of other people, everyone out there.
Yeah. There are about 25 different things they do better than everybody else that I've identified. And one of them in and of itself isn't responsible for the returns, but I would argue that if you put them all together, they are. It's everything from how they operate as an organization in that everybody shares information internally. Everyone sees their code. They have this super secret code, 30,000 plus lines of code. And anybody can have access to it. We're talking even like the secretaries. And the idea is Simons wants people working in a collegial manner. And it generally works. And I've never seen anything like that, any other software company, tech company, investment company. And the idea being that, okay, if this group is running into a problem, instead of shutting their computers and moving on, somebody else kind of sees, they do shut the computer and move on, but another group sees it and takes the ball from them. I don't know if that's a British expression, but yeah, in America, they take the ball and runs with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And so they manage in a very different way, create different incentives I write about in the book. They recruit in a different way. They don't hire anybody from the world of finance. It's all math and scientists, astronomers, different types of worlds of science, physicists, different worlds, areas of science.
Yeah.
They also just trade in a different way. Short term, it's based on patterns. It's few days holding period. Generally, they don't hold for longer than that. Everything they hold the long and short at the same time, so they don't care what the market does. Market can go up, market can go down. It's all automated at this point. A lot of machine learning. So it's humans helping the machine. So there are a lot of things they do much differently and better than everybody else.
And coming back to Jim's sort of management style and, well, expertise in building great teams, if there is something you would learn from that, what do you think Jim did that was so special in how he constructed these teams?
A lot of different things. One is that they don't hire for need, unlike any kind of business I've ever seen. They don't kind of need a programmer and go and look for a programmer. They just look for smart people, accomplished people. And everyone today, at least in the world of finance, is looking to hire PhDs. Oh, I got a PhD. And you take a tour of an office and they point out in that corner office over there, that's our PhD. Well, yeah, they've got PhDs at Jim Simon's firm, Renaissance Technologies, but we're talking people that ran mathematics department at Stanford. So these are people who've accomplished a lot. So they will target people who've accomplished important things in the world of math and science, and then try to get them and then hire them, even if they don't really know what they're going to do at the firm. And I've never seen, again, anything like that. They just make the bet that when a smart, driven person is hired, they will find a way to improve their system, their trading system.
Yeah.
So it's a great, if other businesses can embrace it, that'd be great. In other words, you just hire somebody super smart and driven and accomplished and let them figure out a way to add value. And again, most companies don't have that luxury of being able to do that. But if you can, it's a good way to operate.
Yeah, that was really interesting. It's sort of saying intelligence is basically more important than knowledge of an industry.
Intelligence, motivation to, right. They figure, especially when it comes to finance, they can teach them finance. They don't really want people even with some background in finance because they maybe have some bias at that point. They almost want to teach them a new way. But yeah, they don't really care their knowledge base. They care what they've accomplished in different areas, and they figure they can apply it. And sometimes it's good to bring in someone who knows something about astronomy but knows nothing about finance, and we'll teach you finance, but you've done all this great work in astronomy. That's their argument anyway, their approach.
And would you say, like, you've obviously digged into that quite a lot, so you would agree with that principle as a general strategy for businesses out, like general business, basically, it's a good thing for...
I don't know. It's a good question. So, you know, one can criticize my work. Zuckerman writes about the winners. I don't write often, at least my books, my articles are often about the losers, but my books are about the winners. So it's a self-selecting group. So for every Jim Simons who hires and motivates this way and approaches talent this way, maybe there's somebody else who tries it and fails that Zuckerman doesn't write about. But it does work for Jim Simons. I think it's worth considering. For most people. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. Also in the book, you talk about how Robert Mercer used his wealth and experience to gain from Rentec to help Donald Trump win the 2016 election. Can you describe how he was able to do that?
Sure. So Robert Mercer is a fascinating individual in his own right. A computer scientist. He was working at IBM for a while. Very unusual, quirky guy. I write in the book about how at IBM, he would eat the same exact lunch every day. He would set out his chips. What do you call them? Crisps? What do you call them?
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
There you go. In order of size on the table, and eat the broken ones first and eat up to the largest ones. unusual individual, and then but really impressive and brilliant even. And then he got to Simon's firm, and we're talking 1993 or so. And at the time, they were making money in areas like bonds and commodities and currencies, but they could not figure out equities, stocks. And it was bothering them. And Simons gave his group just a few more months, and he's going to pull the plug on the whole effort. And frankly, had they not succeeded in equities, they would never have been able to accomplish and make as much as they did and be as big as they did, because the equity market is just much bigger than these other ones, and you can trade a lot more. So Mercer, along with his colleagues, a guy named Peter Brown, who runs the firm today, set out to figure it out. And there were difficulties, and there was a glitch. And it's a reminder that even these super brilliant computer programmers and others can make dumb mistakes too. And there was one dumb mistake that a more junior guy, interesting character in his own right, David Magerman, stumbled upon, and they fixed it. But thanks to Mercer and his colleagues, they became a power, trading power, and started making billions and billions. And as a result, Mercer himself became a billionaire. And for a while, he was sort of treated as sort of an interesting, quirky kind of person individually at the lunchroom. They would all meet for lunch every day. He's a conservative individual, and he would start picking on the liberals, teasing them, mocking them maybe. But it was a back and forth. It was in good humor and good fun. But over time, it became a little more annoying. And then finally, people started realizing that in his private life, he was funding a lot of causes that maybe others weren't as passionate about or not in favor of even. Things like opposing a mosque in New York City at the where the 9/11 bombing was, that area downtown. He got behind Breitbart, and he got behind Brexit financially. Neil Farage and others he backed. And then in 2016, he became one of the most important backers, I would argue the most important, both financially and otherwise, of Donald Trump. And he and his daughter, Rebecca, who was behind the political efforts as well, went to Trump in August of 2016 when he was struggling in the polls. And this video just came out about him acknowledging groping women. And it looked like he was not going to win Trump. And the Mercers said to Trump, "You've got to put these two individuals at the helm of your campaign. That'll be Steve Bannon and Kellyanne Conway." And, you know, love them or hate them, they did turn that campaign around.
Yeah.
And Trump eventually won, as we all know. And he thanked Bob Mercer for making it happen. So he really, I would argue, if not for Bob Mercer, and Trump has said, Donald Trump would not be in office.
Yeah. And he was, as you said, involved in Brexit as well, with Cambridge Analytica.
Right. I meant to say that. Yeah, good point.
And I was just going to ask you what you personally thought about moral implications of using data to impact political campaigns. Where do you think the line is, or is there a line?
That's a good question. I think it's important to use data. One of the big themes of my book is how too often we in society rely on intuition and judgment as opposed to data. So one of my concerns, frankly, is that when it comes to the most important decisions of our life, you look in the White House, Donald Trump says how proud he is. He's using his gut a lot of the times, and that's scary to me. Important decisions in the world of investing, they're not made with gut anymore. It's data-driven systems. And yet, when it comes to these important decisions in the White House, it's gut instinct, which is a little bit scary. But when it comes to your question, listen, there's a line. Personal data that people don't allow, that people don't want to be used, don't acknowledge, that should never be used, obviously. But I think all parties today, in the left and the right, they sort of comb the internet for data that they can use. But, you know, you can't step over that line. And that was the accusation, obviously, of Cambridge. And it's still not entirely clear whether I'm not a big defender of Cambridge, but it's not clear when they crossed the line. And it was this university professor. And yeah, it's still a subject of debate.
We hope you're enjoying the episode. For interviews like this every Thursday, subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. And while you're there, make sure you give us a star rating and leave guest suggestions along with any other feedback in the review section. Now, back to the show.
Now, there's a common belief from many people in that work in the stock market that quants can be very good when the models understand current market dynamics. However, they can fall down when the market behavior changes suddenly, such as potentially in this situation where, you know, with COVID, we hadn't experienced something like that before in the stock market, a rapid decline such as that due to something that wasn't related really to a recession or anything. Jim, however, I think posted a 39% gain or something in its flagship Medallion fund through to April 14th. What do you think makes Jim different here? Do they just have superior models than others, or?
Well, that's a good question. I should make clear. So their key funds, the Medallion fund, which I write about in my book, is still doing really well. Right now we're talking in August of 2020, and they're still up like 50% on the year, which is just remarkable. But they have other funds that don't aim for the same kind of returns or different types of approach, and they're not doing nearly as well. They're actually having really poor years. So even Simons and his firm are having some struggles this year.
Yeah.
And to your point, quantitative approach is not foolproof, not at all. And even they, people internally, one of the reasons why they're still kind of working so hard and even neurotic about it is they are worried that things are changing in the market. And I've posed to them a series of questions, people internally, my concerns. I mean, I'm a skeptical journalist, so I wonder if they're going to continue to do as well. And the market is changing. There's less, or until recently, when young people got back in the market and the Robin Hood phenomenon, et cetera, in the United States anyway, Robin Hood isn't yet in the UK. Until recently, you know, people were shifting to passive investing, ETFs and such. So that is the whole basis. So to your point, to your question, why does Simons do so well? They've got this automated system that sort of takes advantage of the mistakes that we all make, the greed, the fear, the panic. Mm-hmm. And they've got these patterns mapped out. They know these few day patterns and how they feed it into the system. They know through historic data how things are going to act. But it's not foolproof. Like you said, markets are always changing. So they're always updating their models. And can they keep updating them? So far, so good when it comes to Medallion. But let's see about the future.
Sure. And you've also written about how 85% of all trading is on autopilot. I believe that was from Marko Kalanovic of JP Morgan. So it's controlled by machines, models, or passive investing formulas. So, which has basically created an unprecedented trading herd that moves in unison and is blazing fast. So do you think this has been one of the primary forces behind the sort of flash crashes and rapid ascents we've been seeing in the stock market after the initial COVID decline?
To some extent, but we had some of those rapid declines before computer trading as well. And also, if you're going to blame them for the flash crashes, we got to give them credit as well for the fact that the market's pretty much been up for years now. Yep. At this point. So it's a mixed blessing. Yes, you're going to have those flash crashes once in a while when the models go berserk, but those are, you know, just a few minutes, not fun, small periods, but yeah, you're going to have to deal with that. But, you know, keep in mind, you know, people panicked in the past as well when it was all humans too.
Yeah. What do you think the implications are for retail investors with this new dynamic that, you know, most of the trading is from machines, et cetera? Does it make it more difficult for you?
I think as an individual, you can't really compete with Jim Simons and Renaissance and the machines. You don't want to anyway. You can try, but meaning that they all trade, these people I write about in my book, they trade on a short-term basis. Certainly less than a year. So as a result, the individual needs to become a longer term holder.
Okay, that's interesting.
Which is a little smarter anyway. So not that people listen to me. I've got two sons upstairs, teenagers who are on their Robinhood account, day trading. So no one listens to me anyway. So people have this temptation, the lure of the quick trade, but it's just hard to pull off successfully. So I'm considering what's going on upstairs as an inexpensive lesson. We'll see what happens.
And you've also mentioned that many of these trading models that machines use momentum as an indicator. Do you think retail investors should be looking at similar indicators that these machines use, or?
No, because then you're competing with the machines. I would try to be Look for inefficiencies, small inefficiencies, and they're rare. But there are still times when you have some edge, and that could be you're in an industry, you're a doctor. And I don't want to encourage doctors trading. They're the worst traders. Dentists, they're the very worst. So they think they know more than they do. But there are times when there's some new invention in the world of medicine and you've got firsthand knowledge of it. Or I don't know, you're in some industry and you've got a little bit of an edge. And everyone thinks they have an edge. But you know, there'll be some product that you're aware of before others. And there's no way Simons and the computers are going to be as in touch with that. So there are still ways to get an edge. But it's just much more rare, much more difficult to get that kind of edge than in the past. So the bulk of your money should really be cheap index funds.
Yep.
I'm not giving advice. I'm not allowed to do that. But I would think, you know, cheap index funds, and then at the margin have some money that you trade with where you can get some edge.
Sure. And you briefly mentioned the new day traders, the Robinhood investors. What consequences do you think that has to, if any, to the market?
It's a good question. We're still trying to digest that. It's a relatively recent phenomenon. There are some who say that these people aren't as important pushing things around. Some people say they are. You can see the impact on some stocks. Like in the United States, we had this Hertz is the largest rental car company. And recently it's been soaring, even though it's bankrupt. It's literally bankrupt. And
yeah,
I talked to Carl Icahn, who got out of the stock at like 80 cents a share, 70 cents a share. And he was thrilled to get out at that point. But the Robinhood guys got in there and bought it up and sent it flying.
Yeah.
Because they figure Hertz, hey, I've heard of Hertz. It's got to do well. And it's $1.50 right now as we speak. So some of them have made money. A lot of them have lost money. So you can see impact on specific individual stocks. I don't know yet. I haven't seen academic data showing on the overall market.
Do you think this is that's the new normal, that it's going to be stocks like this that gets huge amount of interest from retail investors, you know, with the rise of social media and Robinhood and all sort of acting as the same sort of tribe in a way? Is that the new normal for some?
I don't know. So anecdotally, one of my sons has returned to betting on sports games now that they're back. So maybe the Robinhood guys are going to shift back to gambling when gambling is allowed. I also want to emphasize that there's some positive aspects too. So young people weren't really interested in the market until recently, and that's not healthy either. If they can learn about the market and start investing and keep some of their money, at least some of it in the broader market and index funds kind of thing, that's really healthy. And they're learning. Maybe this is, again, just like for my sons, it's an inexpensive lesson, hopefully for others. So I don't think it's a negative phenomenon necessarily, as long as people aren't playing their, you know, their life savings.
Yeah. Do you believe that there's some common traits that make the titans of finance so successful?
Yes. Are there? Yes. A, they love what they do. B, they're always like sponges seeking knowledge, seeking new opinions. I'll give you more of a common denominator of those who've blown it. So I've written about many who made a lot and then lost a lot. And they usually got too big. They managed too much money. That was the case with John Paulson, the subject of my first book. He's still as smart as he ever was, but he ended up managing too much money. And then you end up going with not just your best ideas, but your second, your tertiary ideas. But also you surround yourself, I find with all my books, there's a phenomenon where the really successful people start surrounding themselves with yes men. I don't know if that's a phrase in the UK well, but I find that often. And there's a temptation. You're a billionaire and you've done really well in life. And you end up hiring people that tell you how great you are. And that leads to real problems. And I've seen it time and time again.
Yeah.
So that's a real issue, that they don't have people telling them, hey, boss, you're an idiot here. I don't think you're right. I don't think you have to say it that way, but I disagree with you, boss. That's been a real issue with a lot of the people that I've written about. So those are kind of two big issues that I've found. They get too big and they surround themselves with people, not just, you know, investing analysts, but, you know, PR kind of people, just people that don't give them constructive criticism.
Okay. So again, we're sort of saying that potentially the team is one of the reasons all these people do so well. It's not them individually.
Oh, yeah. You know, people criticize my book. They're like, well, Greg, it says Jim Simons in the title, but it's really about Jim and all his people. And the same thing with the Frackers and Greatest Trade Ever. My first book, it says John Paulson, but it's really about lots of other. And that's exactly true. And I find the team aspect really enjoyable and fascinating, too. It's various interesting characters. They're all kind of quirky. They're all sort of ignoring the experts, at least the ones that I write about. So Simons had this approach that ignored sort of the George Soros style of investing, of looking at broad trends and using your judgment. And it ignored the efficient market hypothesis that suggested that there couldn't be a Jim Simons. The Frackers is about people who ignored the conventional wisdom that you couldn't find any more oil and gas in the United States.
Yeah.
I mean, all the majors, the oil giants had given up on America. Yeah. And yet these guys made a big bet on America. And that's what that book's about. And my first book, The Greatest Trade Ever, is about the people who ignore the conventional wisdom that the United States and the globe and the world couldn't experience a synchronized economic and housing downturn. And these people I write about ignore that conventional wisdom. So that is another common phenomenon where these people have a self-confidence to ignore what the common wisdom is. Mm.
Yeah, that's very interesting. Thanks, Gregory. It's been really great to chat to you, and I really appreciate the time you've given us. Did you want to close by saying a bit more about where people can find your book and other information from you?
Of course. So yes, Amazon and all the leading booksellers, you can find all my books, but I also encourage people to reach out to me with constructive criticism. Some of my best colleagues and sources are people that say, Greg, I like this, but you made a mistake here, and let me show you why. And I welcome that. I embrace that. I'm always learning and trying to improve. So I'm on LinkedIn. I'm on Twitter. Easy to find on the Wall Street Journal. And just email me, Gregory.Zuckerman, with a Z. There you go, right? At WSJ.com. Yep. So feel free to reach out to me.
Excellent. Well, thanks very much, Greg. Really appreciate it.
Of course. Stay well, everybody.
Cheers. Thanks very much, Greg.
Thanks for listening, everyone. Just a quick note before we sign off. If you're looking for an easily digestible daily update on the markets, this might be of interest to you. Opto Updates is our short newsletter sent every day during a trading week, giving you a bulleted list of the top 7 stories from the global stock markets. We've done the hard work for you, highlighting relevant opportunities and trends. And in addition, we'll also keep you notified of any new podcasts, stock reports, or events from the Opto world. If you're interested, sign up using the link in the show notes. Until next time.